Let's try this Easter Sunday greeting again. So I say, Christ is risen. And then you, with equal enthusiasm, say, He is risen indeed. Are you ready? Christ is risen. Amen. My name's Miranda. I'm another of the pastors here. And it is a special privilege, always, to preach on Easter Sunday. This is the day that we celebrate the event that changed everything forever. Jesus fights death and wins. And he comes to life, but in a new life, a life that makes it possible for us to do the same. There's a verse which has been really important to me over the years, and it kind of sums up everything for me today. It's this one, Hebrews 12, 1-2. Let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Now, over these last weeks, if you've been around, we've been looking at parables. And we've been looking particularly at the idea that Jesus' parables both hide things and reveal things to us. So we have this little display up here, and you can see where we've been. We started here with the house that was built on the sand and the house that was built on the rock. And then we had a look at the mustard seed, the tiny seed which grows into a great tree. And then we looked at the workers in the vineyard and how God's justice kind of blends into mercy when we don't expect it. And then we looked at the friend in the night who comes to ask for bread and is received, and how much bigger and greater God is than that. We looked at the fig tree, which is now very prophetically withered, but the fig tree that represented how God has mercy and grace, judgment, yes, but mercy. And then finally on Friday, we looked at the parable of the wicked tenants who killed the son who is sent to them in grace and in love. Now, this last one got a bit big to fit into the shelf. Isn't it beautiful? Thank you, Kathy Heath. She put her magic together for this, and it's just a beautiful picture of what we're going to talk about today, the banquet table. So the parable we're exploring this morning, the banquet table, what I want us to think about is how this is about that future joy that was set before Jesus and the question of who will actually be there to celebrate with him. I'm going to read the story to you again. Jesus is having a meal at a prominent Pharisee's house, he says. And one of the people at the table with Jesus heard him say these things. And he said to Jesus, "Blessed is the one who will eat in the feast in God's kingdom." And Jesus replies, strangely, with a story. Jesus replied, "A certain man was preparing a great banquet. He invited many guests. Then the day of the banquet arrived, and he sent his servant to those who had been invited. And the servant told them, 'Come, everything is ready now.' But they all had the same idea. They began to make excuses. The first one said, 'I've just bought a field. I have to go and see it. Please excuse me.' Another said, 'I've just bought 5 pairs of oxen. I'm on my way to try them out. Please excuse me.' And still another said, 'I just got married, so I can't come.' The servant came back and reported this to the master, and the owner of the house became angry. He ordered his servant, 'Go out quickly into the streets and the lanes of the town. Bring in those who are poor. Also bring in those who can't see or walk.' 'Sir,' the servant says, 'what you ordered has been done, but there is still more room.' And then the master told his servant, 'Go out to the roads, go out to the country lanes, make the people come in. I want my house to be full. I tell you, not one of these people who are invited will get a taste of my banquet.'" An intriguing story. We need a few little kind of cultural insights just to give us more understanding of what's going on here. The first one is this. In the first century Middle East, banquets were not about having fun with your friends. They were very much a formal occasion where the social status of the person who invited and the people who were invited was made clear. So it's for maintaining, for creating social status. Who the host invited and who he invited, it made a very clear statement about the status of the both. There were even seats in the same places every time, and each seat had significance, and some of them had special names. Now, hospitality. There were quite clear rules about how hospitality worked. For guests, these are the rules. Honour your host. Defer to your host in all things. Accept everything that your host offers. For hosts, the rules are similar. Honour your guest. Protect your guest's honour. Something very difficult if your two guests began to dispute with each other, because whose honour do you go with? Give your guests precedence, the precedence they are due. So give each one, recognise their particular place in society. And above all, give guests the best you have. Okay, it must not seem as though you are giving them something less than you could. So these are the rules, and everybody knows the rules. Now, final little piece you need to know is about how invitations work. There are two stages of invitations. The first was the initial invitation. Please come to my banquet on such and such a day. But then, because it took time to cook and all of those kind of things, there would be a second invitation to say, everything's ready now, come and we will celebrate together. And I guess it's not that different from what we might do. We might say, come over for dinner on Saturday, and your guests arrive at 5:30, 6 o'clock. But then there's a point at about 7 or so where you go, okay, everything's on the table, dinner's ready, come and let's eat. So the invitation in this story is that second one. These people have already said yes, and now it's time to eat. So, in this story, the host has gone ahead and prepared. But when he sends to say the dinner is ready, there's these really interesting words. They all had the same idea. They began to make excuses. So what's going on here? It's not just three of the guests who unavoidably had something come up and really had to apologise and couldn't come. That might be understandable. This is a strategically planned social sabotage of the host. These people, and not just three of them, it says they all had the same idea. Three is kind of a bit of a thing for a story, isn't it? The first, the second, the third, or a joke. So they're just representatives. These guests are deliberately breaking all the rules of hospitality in an attempt to shame the host at his own banquet. And we would kind of feel that even today, I think. There's a certain sense that if we are having a special event, we want people to want to come. A dear friend of mine says, I had to cancel a couple of different times where I was going to meet her. And she's like, I know that you had to do that, but I still feel like you blow me off. That sense, you know. We had a friend who had an 18-year-old who had a birthday party, but unfortunately for him, on the same night, another more popular person also had an 18th birthday party, and most of the friends who were coming to his ended up going to the other one. And so this poor boy got a very clear idea of what his social status actually was. Even my own son had his formal on Thursday night, and the week before, when all of the jostling about who sits on whose table at the formal was happening, he had friends say to him, well, look, you're kind of our second choice. If this other person says no, you can sit on our table. And that hurts, even today. So the host has a choice. What is he going to do? Well, he could wear the shame. He could do nothing. He could choose to take some kind of revenge on these guests that have really deliberately snubbed him. But he makes a really interesting choice. He decides instead to overturn the whole system. This is an unexpected and a courageous choice. And like the vineyard owner that we looked at on Friday, the host decides to reprocess his anger into grace. He invites people that he knows don't expect an invite, that will never be able to repay him, that will actually harm rather than enhance his social standing. And he invites them freely. Just on a little side note here, you might notice a word. It talks about the guests being made to come in. And that might make you feel a little awkward. Let me explain a little bit more about that. The word is more like urging or convincing. And I think it's not that the guests don't want to come. It's just that the invitation is just so flabbergastingly unusual. Do you know what I mean? So they would be like so even wary and suspicious. Like, why is this nobleman inviting me to his banquet? And so the first answer would probably be, oh, no thanks. But they need convincing that this offer is actually genuine and they are really wanted at this banquet. And so where you hear make, it's more like convince, persuade, urge. The other thing I'd want to say is parables, you can't always just kind of match up exactly each detail of them and map them on top of reality. And so while we say this host represents God, we certainly don't want to be saying God has peers who shame him, or God invites all the important people first and only invites the others later. These are not things that we recognise about God's character. They're just part of the story. Now, this important piece of the puzzle, why Jesus chooses to tell a story about a banquet. This isn't just a handy picture plucked out of the air. It's actually an established part of Jewish social and spiritual understanding. And it's come through hundreds of years of thought and development. It's like this parable is one scene from an epic movie called The Promise of the Messianic Banquet. Let me read you from Isaiah 25, which is a good 800 years earlier. On Mount Zion, the Lord who rules over all will prepare a feast for all the nations. The best and richest foods and the finest aged wines will be served. On that mountain, the Lord will destroy the veil of sadness that covers all the nations. He will destroy the gloom that is spread over everyone. He will swallow up death forever. The Lord and King will wipe away the tears from everyone's face. He will remove the shame of his people from the whole earth. The Lord has spoken. Isn't that a beautiful picture? This picture of the joy experience when the Messiah comes to rescue and restore not only his people Israel, but all nations, all people. The banquet represents this celebration where God has dealt with all the fear and the ugliness and the pain, and death itself is beaten and swallowed up forever. This is the picture that Jesus is tapping into in this story. And we are still waiting for that final celebration, aren't we? But we rejoice because we now know how it will come about. We know because of Jesus' resurrection. So this picture is strong in the minds of the guests sitting around the table with Jesus when he tells this story. But the meaning has become a little bit kind of bent out of shape over the centuries. Many Jews believed about the Messianic banquet, but they believed the prophecy couldn't really include the Gentiles. Some believed that it did, but that the Gentiles would turn up at the banquet and actually be judged and slaughtered. You might remember the Dead Sea Scrolls that were discovered a couple of decades ago. In the Qumran community, there's a really interesting line about the Messianic banquet, and it says this: no one can attend if they are paralyzed in feet or hands, or lame, or deaf or blind or dumb, or smitten in their flesh with a visible blemish. How interesting is that when we see who Jesus invites to the banquet? So this beautiful vision of this all-inclusive celebration has somehow become a mark of righteousness, a mark of exclusivity for the Jewish people. And out of this understanding comes the comment, "Blessed is the one who will eat at the feast in God's kingdom." Now, maybe this is the kind of comment that's often made at dinners and banquets. And the expected response would probably be something like, "May we be among the righteous who sit at that table." So when Jesus completely changes direction and goes for the jugular and overturns all those expectations, he is shocking his fellow guests. He says, not only are all welcome, but the ones who assume that they will be there will not get the smallest bit. So the central question, the challenge of this story is simply this: who will be there? Who will be there at the banquet? Now, every guest is invited to the banquet, has to respond, and interestingly, they all respond according to their own assumptions. The first invited guests assume that their invite is there for the taking. They've received this first invite, now they can do what they like with it. They're sure enough of their position even to exploit the position they have. After all, there's bound to be another invite later, surely, when our host wants to reassert his status. And maybe we'll go to that one. So perhaps their excuses are genuine, although it's unlikely. Perhaps they simply have priorities that rank higher than the banquet right now: home and family, building wealth. I wonder if this rings true for you at all. Do you have a plan to really devote yourself to living for Jesus sometime in the future, when there's less going on in your life? Maybe after year 12 or after uni, or when you've established yourself career-wise, or when the kids are older, or when the kids have left home, or when the grandkids are older? What if that time never comes? What if that time is now? The later guests, they also make assumptions. Different ones. "Oh, these fancy banquets, they're not for the likes of me. No one would want me there. I couldn't possibly be invited to something so grand and intimidating. And thank goodness for that, because I've got nothing to wear, nothing to bring. I'll just embarrass myself. What if somehow I'm expected to repay? I'll never be able to do it. This will hang over me for the rest of my life." How can we know that these thoughts are there for the last guests? Well, the host anticipates it, doesn't he? He tells his servant, "You're going to have to persuade these people. Don't take no for an answer. They're going to need convincing." Does this maybe ring true for you? Do you find it hard to believe that God really wants you? Are you afraid of the possible consequences of tossing in everything with Jesus? I mean, what will he want from you? In time, in money, in the whole uncomfortable transformation of who you are and how you see yourself? Do you feel inadequate for this invite? Does it make you want to hang back or even say no? Perhaps you have plans to follow Jesus later when you have everything more together, when you're a better person. But what if that time never comes? Or what if the time to say yes is now? To all potential guests with assumptions, listen to the words of Revelation 19, 6-9. "Then I heard again what sounded like the shout of a vast crowd, or the roar of mighty ocean waves, or the crash of loud thunder. Praise the Lord, for the Lord our God, the Almighty, reigns. Let us be glad and rejoice, and let us give honour to him. For the time has come for the wedding feast of the Lamb, and his bride has prepared herself. She has been given the finest of pure white linen. For the fine linen represents the good deeds of God's holy people. And the angel said to me, write this, blessed are those who are invited to the wedding feast of the Lamb. And he added, these are true words that come from God. Do you notice how these are virtually the same words that are uttered by the guest at the dinner for Jesus? But these words are not a pious wish. They are an all-inclusive invitation for everyone. And all we need to do is accept that invite. Jesus rose from the dead. He made it impossible for anyone who chooses him to be present at this banquet. No one is excluded except by their own decision. And all you need to do is actually choose. Choose him with our hearts, our minds, our wills, our whole lives. Will we be there? I have a favourite character in this story, and I haven't really mentioned him yet. Perhaps I'm filling the gaps a little bit, but I feel as though this master's servant is having the best day ever. Okay, it started badly. There was a bit of a shock with these rude, entitled guests throwing the master's invite back in his face. But then, instead of going for revenge, the master channels that anger into grace, and the servant gets to deliver this grace far and wide to everyone. Perhaps he gets to go out and invite a whole crowd of his less fortunate friends and relatives. Perhaps it's just the joy of delivering surprising good news. That's always fun. He gets to that task so enthusiastically that the story kind of jumps ahead. Done, says the servant. But there's still room. Suggestion in his words? Then go and find more and urge them to come, says the master. And so off he hurries to find more, for whom the news is so surprising he actually has to work hard to convince him that it's real. N.T. Wright says this, it isn't enough to say that we ourselves are the people dragged in from the country lanes, to our surprise, to enjoy God's party. That may be true, but party guests are then expected to become party hosts in their turn. If we have already accepted that invite, if we are already Jesus' followers, then our task is to go out and to invite others. We're still in the middle of this story. The invite is still open. There is still room. And just like the servant, we are called to find more guests and to convince them to come to Jesus' banquet. Maybe there are already people in your life that assume they're not invited, that need some urging, that need someone to come and find them and tell them. Pray for them. Speak to them. There is still room. Let me finish with the verse that I started with. Let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us, fixing our eyes on Jesus, the pioneer and perfecter of faith. For the joy set before him, he endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. The risen Jesus invites us today to join him in the joy set before him, to run with perseverance, to fix our eyes on him, to feast and to celebrate with him for eternity, and to join the task of bringing others along too. We have an opportunity now to respond. We're going to listen to Jane and Jess bring us a song which brings us Jesus' invitation again. And I encourage you to take that opportunity to respond to him in your hearts and your minds this morning. Amen.